Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable, the day we speak with journalists about the week's news. We begin today's show by talking about how Italy has managed to get a handle on the deadly COVID pandemic. Italy was hit very hard earlier this year. Italy's health minister says the worst is over, but people need to remain cautious. We will also talk about the $860 billion recovery fund to help the 27-member EU bloc tackle their economic crisis. Joining us is Eric Reguli, European Bureau Chief for the Globe and Mail. Hi, Eric. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose. Great to be back.
Well, it's great to have you, Eric. It's been a little while since we've had you on. Things have really changed in Italy. Give us an update. How are things going there now?
Well, it's, I remember, Rose, when we talked, two or three months ago, it was a panic here. I mean, in March and April, we were getting 5,000, 6,000 new cases a day, 1,000 deaths a day. We were Italy. Was number one in the world for a couple of months and extreme lockdown. But I'm happy to say that the worst really is over. I mean, just today, for example, there were five deaths and 250 new cases. Now, having said that, Italy is still has the second most deaths in Europe after Britain with 35,000 deaths. The number of cases is 245,000, which is still very high, but the fatality rate and the new infection rate have absolutely plummeted, plummeted.
And Italy's health minister, Roberto Speranza, says the worst is over, but people really need to remain cautious. He said that a second wave is possible.
Yeah, I think a second wave is possible, but I actually don't know. I don't believe, Rose, that a second wave in Italy or in Europe will be as big as the wave that hit in March and April. Why do I say that? Because in Europe, first of all, people are wearing masks here. I mean, we don't have in Europe and in Italy, we don't have a cultural problem like many Americans have with wearing masks. It happens here. You walk out the door, you wear a mask. You walk into a shop, you wear a mask. It's just part of life now. The second reason is the Europeans, and especially the Italians, are very good at testing and tracing and locking down. So I think there's going to be sporadic hotspots, like flare-ups, as there was in Catalonia and Spain the other day. But they're moving very fast to detect them and isolate them quickly. We had a minor outbreak in Rome, where I live, a few days ago. There was a plane from Bangladesh. I think there was 21 positives got off the plane, and they found them and they shut them down really fast. If they had, they could have infected hundreds or thousands.
Mm. You know, Eric, as you know, the cases in the U.S. are going up every day. Unfortunately, the death rate is going up. There doesn't seem to be an end in sight. A lot of people at the state and local level say, without a federal plan, you know, how are we going to get through this? So what lessons can we learn from how Italy really tackled this crisis?
Yeah, I think the best lesson is... have a free national healthcare system. I mean, if you look at the countries in the world where the pandemic is the worst and out of control, I mean, I'm talking, you know, the United States is the best example. India, Bangladesh, these are countries where there is no free healthcare system, or the healthcare system that exists doesn't work very well. I mean, look at Canada, where I'm from, compared to the United States. I mean, in Canada, you're not afraid of doctors because you don't have to pay for doctors. You're not afraid of going to hospital because you don't walk out with a $100,000 or a $500,000 bill. So it's in Europe, it's the same way. The healthcare systems in Europe are generally pretty good. as good or better than Canada's. And so you're not afraid to go see a doctor, not afraid to go to a hospital to get treatment. That's lesson number one. Of course, that's not going to change overnight in the United States, or not ever. A second lesson is that you got to switch your thinking in the sense that a lockdown, a tight, long lockdown, doesn't destroy an economy. It actually helps it get out of lockdown faster. So it's the reverse of the thinking of Donald Trump. He thought that locking down long is going to wreck the economy. Well, they locked down hard in Europe, but we pretty much reopened, and we're back in business. Mm.
Eric Reguli is European Bureau Chief for the Globe and Mail. And now I would like to welcome Kevin Hall to the show. Kevin is Chief Economics Correspondent and Senior Investigator at McClatchy Newspapers. Hi, Kevin. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back.
Well, it's great to have you. Kevin, yesterday we did a show about how so many small businesses are struggling to survive. So many have permanently shut down. And our guest said, you know, how do you help small businesses? You really get a handle on COVID. That's the point that Eric just made. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's at the risk of sounding patronizing, it's not rocket science. I mean, if you don't, there's been a lot of talk about how come small businesses suffer more? Well, the larger businesses, the chains, McDonald's, I think just today had an announcement that they're going to require face masks at all their places. And, the Walmarts and the Winn-Dixies and all the big national chains have been moving in that direction. The cleaning, the things that small businesses have to do to be safe, it's definitely a higher bar. But ultimately, they're the first to buckle. They don't have the resources that large companies have. And, if we don't get the spread under control and the use of masks and distancing, they're the first, they're the canary in the coal mine, so to speak.
Right. And Eric, how are, small businesses doing in Italy? The last time we had you on, we talked about, the cafes, the small restaurants, just all of these, shops that, people love to visit when they visit Italy. How are they doing?
The short answer, Rose, is not well. To Kevin's point, the small businesses are suffering, but they're suffering a lot in Italy, Spain, and Greece, especially because these are heavily tourist-dependent economies. The tourism as percentage of GDP in Italy is 14%. It's something like 17% in Greece, or 20%. I don't know what it is in the United States, but in Canada it's 2%. I imagine it would be similar in the United States. So there's just no tourists. That's point one. Point two, Italy, unlike many countries in the world, is really a small and medium-sized business economy. So they don't have the financial wherewithal to keep going, which is why, and the Italian government's pretty much tapped out, which is why this new recovery fund, which I imagine we'll talk about in a minute, is so welcome here, because there's going to be a lot of money coming into the hard-hit European countries pretty soon.
How is Italy dealing with the high unemployment rate?
Well, it's always been a high unemployment rate. The weird thing, Rose, is the unemployment rates come down. That's it's a bit of a fiction, because so many people have dropped out of, you're only unemployed if you're actually looking for a job and you can't find a job. So many people literally have stopped looking for a job. It's gone. Officially, it's not gone up. Unofficially, it's soaring. So anyone in tourism and hospitality and restaurants and hotels, they are suffering. Now, a few tourists are coming back, but it's mostly European tourists. We're not getting North American tourists whatsoever, and they tend to be the high-spending ones.
Right. Kevin, we were really struck by a headline in the New York Times, European workers draw paychecks, American workers scrounge for food. And it really focused on the fact that, European countries provided 70 to 85% of people's wages, whereas in the United States, people got laid off and they had to go on unemployment. So very stark differences.
Yeah. I mean, I think part of it has to do with the social safety net. It's a a more complex equation because they also have, you know, state-provided or state-run, not necessarily, they have a private element in healthcare, but in most of the European countries, there's a state oversight of the healthcare system. So you think about not just how workers are dealt with, but the competitiveness, for instance. U.S. companies complain that, you know, they're forced to compete abroad against companies who don't have this very expensive healthcare component to it. Beyond the fact that we don't have the same sort of social safety net, we also leave it to the states. And I think you look at states like Florida, where the collapse of the unemployment system has been abysmal. Mm-hmm. And even with that terrible, terrible situation and how people have waited weeks and weeks, you know, in some cases 3 months before they collect their first payment, they've still given out $11 billion in assistance, which is a pretty remarkable number when you think about it. How much money is going out the door, even in a system that isn't delivering it well, if that makes
right.
sense.
Right. Yeah, Kevin, can you talk just about how this has all worked and played out? As this New York Times piece points out, the United States has relied on an expansion of unemployment insurance, which unfortunately is going to expire this weekend, and we're going to talk more with Kevin about that in the second half of the show. But European countries, Denmark, Ireland, Britain, France, Spain, Austria, the Netherlands, have prevented joblessness by nationalizing payrolls, heavily subsidizing wages, and enabling paychecks to continue uninterrupted. So now that we're in July, how is this working?
It seems to be working pretty well, Rose. You know, Germany led the charge in this during the financial crisis, you know, 10, 11, 12 years ago. They had a system where they would reduce employees' hours. So they would go, say, from 5 days to 4 days a week, or even three, and their pay would come down a bit, but they wouldn't be fired or laid off. And that's how they kept it going. So there's versions of that going on throughout Europe. There's payroll support, as there is in the United States, but you don't see, unlike the United States, you don't see companies, you know, firing all or most of their people. That's just not happening.
Do you see, you know, real suffering like you see in the United States? I believe it was CNBC, I want to make sure I get this right, over 20 million people in the United States are going hungry right now. They just don't have enough to eat. And I'm sure you've seen the video, Eric, of long lines at food banks in many parts of the country.
Yeah, these long lines of people in, you know, in cars lining up for food. This is shocking to Europeans. You are not seeing that here at all. Part of the reason is, to my, you know, first point, there's health care here, so people know they're not going to have to spend money on health care. That gives them that, or an emergency, that gives them some comfort that they're not going to go bankrupt. Small and medium-sized businesses, yes, they're losing their jobs, but there is some support. I mean, the question is, how much longer can these governments afford to keep doing this? And the big companies they're not doing wholesale firings like they do in some other countries. So overall, I would say that, you know, especially in Germany, less so in Italy, less so in Spain, there's a comfort feeling here. Now, the problem, I got to mention this, is that in some countries, especially Spain, Italy, and Greece, there's so many people who work what they call in nero, in black. So they're not part of the tax system. They're not registered. Those are the people who are really suffering, because since they're not registered, they're not in the official social security net. There is some hunger in Italy. It's just not very much. But there are people who are, I'd be lying to say if there weren't, but there are people who are off the grid who are suffering.
Well, this CNBC report cites data from the Center on Budget Policies and Priorities. 26 million adults in the U.S. said people in their households are not eating enough because of lack of funds. And we'll talk more about that with Kevin Hall in the second part of the show. Eric Regulli is European Bureau Chief for the Globe and Mail. Kevin Hall is Chief Economics Correspondent and Senior Investigator at McClatchy Newspapers. And we're talking about how Italy is dealing with its COVID crisis. We're going to now talk about the $860 billion recovery fund to help the 27-member EU bloc tackle their economic crisis. If you have any questions specifically about this, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org or tweet at yourcallradio. So let's talk about this. This week, the 27 EU bloc agreed to a package to help EU members tackle the economic crisis. It's about $860 billion. A lot of people said that this was a landmark decision. Is that right, Eric?
Oh, yeah, it was huge from every angle. Just a couple seconds of background, Rose. The EU is not like the United States, so there is no federal authority that can issue bonds like the United States can and pay for whatever. So at the start of the pandemic in Europe, in the European Union, it was every country for itself. And it didn't work. And the economies got worse, the body count went up, and huge pressure came on the European Union and Brussels to fix this somehow. And after literally 2 months of negotiations, which came close to failing several times, only this week, the European Union is going to issue a massive amount of mutual debt for the first time in its 50, 60-year history. They are going to raise the equivalent of 860 billion U.S. dollars, roughly half in grants, don't have to be repaid, and the other half in extremely low interest loans. And that's going to be portioned out to countries depending on need. So Italy, which has been hit very hard, has high unemployment, it's going to get probably a couple hundred billion dollars. So the hard hit countries are going to benefit the most. Germany probably the least. Why is this great? Because it's pulling everyone together, but also in the political sense, it's a really big integration move. Now, if you go back a few months, there was talk about the EU shattering, the euro shattering, because it couldn't get through this pandemic. The pandemic was supposed to be the fatal blow. Well, not anymore. You're talking about, for the first time, real unity. And as a result, I mean, there's huge investor confidence in Europe now. The euro's going up. The bond yields are the interest rates on the sovereign bonds is going down. So it's been a highly positive move.
Eric, you said in the beginning it was every country for itself. So what changed?
Well, it wasn't working. Like, for example, in Italy in February and March, when it was, and the country was going to hell. I mean, we didn't know whether, you know, hundreds of thousands of people would die. And Italy said, we need help. We need PPE. We need doctors. We need money. We need everything. And nothing came. And the embarrassment for the EU was the countries that helped Italy were Russia, China, and Cuba. Imagine that. They were sending over PPE. They were sending over doctors. Canada sent over a whole bunch of doctors. And I think that really embarrassed the EU. You know, Italy is the third biggest country in the EU. It's 61 million people, member of NATO, not a belligerent country in recent years, you know, and they were just left to themselves. So I think this embarrassed the EU into pulling together and helping out. So this $860 billion is partly the result of the shabby treatment of Italy at the beginning of the pandemic.
What are your thoughts on this, Kevin, listening to Eric talk about how things changed in Europe and the bailout there at a time when there's no national plan? It's kind of a whack-a-mole policy that we're seeing here in the United States. I also just want to mention on Tuesday, Nurses went to Capitol Hill and they put 160 pairs of white nursing clogs on the lawn to pay tribute to the nurses who've died so far. And they are pushing the Senate to pass the Heroes Act because they still need personal protection equipment.
Yeah, yeah. We've been working in Florida with the Miami Herald quite a bit on this question of nursing homes and rehabilitation centers and the sort, and to this day, the lack of PPEs and the medical equipment and you know people being asked to you know use things for 3 days and it's just you know there's so many places to go with this story in terms of poor management. But I, you know on the question of the stimulus and what they're doing in Europe versus what they're doing in the U.S., you know it's a bit of an apples and oranges because the EU is multiple countries kind of agreeing to do certain things, whereas the U.S. is obviously a completely different structure. And the Federal Reserve has done a ton of stuff to keep, you know, financial markets functioning and banks functioning and all these other things. So, I mean, it's not really an apples and apples comparison. Clearly, the Europeans have had a much more effective communication strategy, much more discipline in how they social distance. And things of the sort. You don't see anywhere else in the world where this has become, with the exception of Brazil, that this has become a political stripe. You know, if you wear a mask, you're one side of the fence, and if you don't wear a mask, you're the other side of a fence. So, yeah, I think as a nation, we ought to be doing some introspection as to, you know, why everybody else seems to have been able to do it right, and we like to hold ourselves up as a shining beacon on the hill, and on this one, we have fallen far, far short of that.
Well, and as Kevin mentioned, I'm sorry, as Eric mentioned, Kevin, they've got a robust healthcare system and a social safety net. I mean, the countries have their own problems, but there is a social safety net, whereas here it just continues to unravel.
Right, and there are little things that make a real difference. For instance, in Germany, they actually have, because of the structure of their health system, many of the main hospitals have the testing capabilities in the hospital, so they can find out in real time whether someone's COVID positive. They don't have to send out and wait, you know, what we're seeing now, 14 days. If you're waiting 11 to 14 days, the test is meaningless because you'll have either had symptoms in that point or spread it if you're asymptomatic. So there are certain things that also go to the structure of the healthcare delivery system that Europe has had some advantages because of their system. That said, you know, one of the things I'm curious about, I see everybody talking about the once we have a vaccine, and they're estimating a billion vaccines, and they'll be free. And it kind of begs the question, well, why would they be free? I mean, the flu shot is covered by your insurance company, or you pay $20 for a flu shot. You know, there are costs to all these things we're doing, whether it's, loan forgiveness or the $1,200 payments to people. And there's going to be a reckoning at the end of this process, and not just here in the United States, but across the globe. And I think, rightly, you have to focus on the problem at hand, not the one you might have in the future. But you should go about that in a way that starts planning for how you unwind this. What are the net effects of giving all this money away? And you need to provide this stimulus. There's no question about that. How is it going to be paid for? You know, Democrats, Joe Biden's going to raise your taxes. Well, if you're not going to raise my taxes, how are we paying for this? You know, so these are conversations we're not having that I think are important to be having as well.
Hmm. Yeah, and Eric, I mean, here in the United States, in San Francisco, it could take 8 days to 2 weeks to get an appointment to get tested and to get your results. But I just wonder, Eric, in most parts of Europe, do you have what's needed in place, for example, testing, contact tracing to deal with outbreaks once they happen?
Short answer is yes. Like a personal story, 2 weeks ago, I got a COVID test. Actually, it was a serological test, which tells you if you've had it in the past. And I went to a clinic, you know, with no appointment at about 10 in the morning. I had the results by 5 o'clock. It was fast, efficient, clean, and it just worked, right? So you have that. But, you know, we didn't have this rose a few months ago. I mean, this is, you know, Europe is, you know, Europe is not on the side of the gods on this. I mean, we had a lot of problems in February, March, and April. We were wholly unprepared in Europe, especially in Italy, even though we knew it was coming. But we got our acts together very quickly. And I think, you know, one of the lessons we learned is you got to test the asymptomatic people. 40% of the asymptomatics are positive. That's the experience in Italy. Generally we're in pretty good shape now on testing and tracing.
And last question, just quickly, Eric, with this $860 billion package, how is most of this money going to be spent?
Well, that's a good question. First of all, the $860 billion, I mean, it sounds like a big figure. It's not, given the size of the EU economy. I mean, the CARES Act in the United States was $2.2 trillion, so it's less than half the size of the American one. It depends. On the loans, countries can do what they want. On the grants, there's conditions attached to it. We will give you, say, 100 billion euros, but you've got to use it. You just can't use it to, you know, buy votes or reduce taxes. You actually have to put it to good use, or else you're not going to be given. So it's conditional. You're not going to be given the money. And that's where there's a lot of fighting, because there's also political, because the EU wants to say, we're not giving you the money, Hungary, if you break the rule of law, or Poland, if you break the rule of law. So, you know, there's going to be a lot of squabbling over this money going out the door in the next few months.
Well, Eric, it's nice to hear your voice. Thank you so much for joining us. And stay safe. We'll have you back soon.
Okay, thanks a lot. Bye-bye, everyone.
Thank you. Eric Reguli is European Bureau Chief for the Globe and Mail. And coming up after a break, we'll continue talking with Kevin Hall, Chief Economics Correspondent with McClatchy Newspapers, about the $600 in unemployment benefits that is going to expire this weekend. And then we will talk about a McClatchy investigation about sexual assault and harassment in the U.S. Coast Guard. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We'll be back after this. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we're joined by Kevin Hall, Chief Economics Correspondent and Senior Investigator at McClatchy Newspapers. Kevin, before we talk about the incredible and very disturbing piece and investigation about sexual harassment in the Coast Guard, I wanted to spend a little bit more time talking about the economy, because a few days ago, we talked about the $600 in federal unemployment benefits that's going to expire this weekend, and that's $600 a week. According to the Washington Post's Jeff Stein, he is tweeting that there's still disagreement among the Republicans. Some want a complex wage replacement scheme. Others warn that states can't pull this off. Well, what we heard from our listeners is that I don't know how I'm going to pay my rent next Saturday. I don't know how I'm going to pay my bills. So what are you hearing from people on Capitol Hill?
Well, on Capitol Hill, not so much, but just in general, I think they're hearing the same thing you're hearing, or that our newspapers are hearing, which is it's a real struggle to make ends meet. And for a lot of people, all you have to do is look at the numbers, right? You know, the market goes crazy because there's a slight improvement hiring back. I don't think we're going to see that in the August numbers, given the unemployment claims numbers, which keep going up three consecutive weeks. But, you know, the people aren't going back to work. The bars and the people who are in most need of this are the ones, you know, who are now at risk, right? The people who've worked the bars, the restaurants, the shopping malls, the people on the lower end of the income scale. And I think that's, it should be abundantly obvious. There had been some discussion of whether it should be capped at $40,000, whether it's that $600 check or the $1,200, the second round of the $1,200 stimulus check. I think the idea, from just a strict economic sense, is to try to get more money flowing through the economy, create demand. I'm not sure that's putting people back to work, and you are starting to see you know, moratoriums are coming to an end on you know, evictions and things like that. And where are people going to go if they're thrown out? I mean, one of the things that's really curious, if you're going to throw someone out on the street because they're not paying their rent because they can't get a job, well, you got 38 million people unemployed. Who's going to step in and take that apartment? You know, I think you're going to find very few takers. So it's a bad situation every way you slice it.
Right. Jeff Stein reports that one plan from the GOP is to cut the $600 weekly benefit to $200 a week through 2020. So that means you're going from, you know, $2,400 a month to $800 a month on top of, you know, depending on where you live, $200 a week at the state level, $400 a week at the state level. I mean, it's really hard to get by on this amount. The second plan from the GOP is to cut $600 a week to $200 a week for several weeks and then replace it with wage replacement based on 70% of prior income. I mean, as they should have done this 2 months ago.
Yeah,
because,
yeah.
You know, the systems are antiquated, Kevin, and even if they come up with a plan, it could take over a month for people to see their benefits kick in again.
Yeah. It leaves people in a lurch, and it goes back to this point. I think the concern, and I think the person who raised it the loudest was Rick Scott of Florida, the senator from Florida, you know, was that you were giving people an incentive not to return to work if they're making more money not working than they would be working. But I don't think there's much out there that shows that's the case. There may be some people, and in Florida, there may be some of that because you have seasonal workers. A lot of people get laid off for 2 or 3 months, like roughly June to September, and then in the hot months when everybody's kind of, the snowbirds are all back home before they come back to Florida. Are they coming back to Florida this year? You know, good question. You know, so there are some dynamics like that, but writ large, that's not a problem nationwide, and I think if you're in Maryland or if you're in Michigan or if you're in Pennsylvania, it's pretty clear that there's not an abundance of places you can go find more work. Who's hiring, right?
Right.
You know, schools aren't going back, so all the people who are, you know, employed through the school system, if they're not in as teachers, then servicing meals or suppliers or maintenance or, you know, go down the line, all these things are disrupted. And, you know, I think they seem to be arguing on a principle rather than facts on the ground.
Right. And to add one more fact in there, the Washington Post cites data from Evercore, an investment bank. And Ernie Tedeschi, who's an economist there, says so far there is no evidence that the $600 payment had either job finding or job leaving effects in May and June data.
Well, and the question is how many got them in real time? I mean, my goodness, in Florida, the waits were enormous. Here in Maryland, where I live, Maryland, which is a state that benefits greatly from proximity to the nation's capital, still had almost as abysmal a program as Florida's was. And a lot of these systems are built off computing systems that date back to the 1980s and 1990s. They're mainframe computers, something that's kind of antiquated in today's world. You know, that's part of the problem, too, that the ability to deliver. The federal government was routing a lot of this money through states, and what we found was that states are ill-equipped to provide it because, you know, this is, in fairness to some states, this is a degree of magnitude, an order of magnitude much greater than everyone hypothetically would build in some cushion that, you know, if the unemployment rate goes from 5 to 8 or something, nobody expects to have kind of a meteor hitting Earth scenario, which is kind of what this is in some ways.
Yeah, and again, I cited that piece from CNBC, 26 million people saying that someone in their household is not eating enough because of lack of funds. Kevin, it's just somewhat shocking that Republicans aren't coming up with some kind of deal, knowing that people are going hungry, people are going to lose their homes, we're going to see higher rates of homelessness. You know, you just have to wonder, what are they thinking here? Why are they waiting so long to come up with some kind of plan?
Yeah. Well, I think it was on your program a number of months ago, I had commented that, you know, this crisis is going to expose income inequality like never before. And I think that's proven true. I don't think it was a particularly brilliant observation. It seemed kind of obvious, and we're seeing it play out. If we already had a big issue of income inequality going into this, it's just, you know, it's to the nth power now, right? In terms of people who already were struggling to find employment are going to have even less chance of employment, are going to have the food banks, you know, anecdotally here locally, you know, the lines are long on Saturdays when I donate food occasionally to the food bank, and just going by there, you see the lines. My family's in Florida. They've got, you know, blocks line. You know, this 5 months into the crisis, it's still, you know, many, many blocks of lines trying to, you know, pick up food, donated food. So it's testing charities, it's testing churches, it's testing communities, and unfortunately, going back to the very beginning of the hour when you were talking about the things to keep this from getting worse and to actually have recovered more quickly, we didn't do the things that everybody, you know, the experts had said we needed to do, and here we are.
Right. Today we are speaking with Kevin Hall, economics correspondent and senior investigator at McClatchy Newspapers. Well, we are going to keep an eye on what is happening with this unemployment benefits crisis and the eviction crisis, and we will continue covering this in the coming weeks. Let's now talk about this incredible investigation about sexual harassment in the U.S. Coast Guard. First off, Kevin, how did you first find out about these cases and these allegations within the Coast Guard?
Well, we, without getting into too much detail, we had heard from some of the people who were looking for someone who would listen to their story, that they've been trying to get help either from members of Congress or through the Inspector General's office and through others, and the more we took a deeper look at it, the more it was clear that this is it caught our attention for a number of reasons. One, our office kind of led the way about six, 7 years ago, on this question of rape in the military. And that was a big issue in 2008, and then it was a big issue again in about 2011 to 2013 as Congress wrestled with ways to kind of bring the Defense Department more into the modern world, kind of like how companies do things, and also to actually have protocols. The Coast Guard kind of went under the radar. The Coast Guard enjoys a number of benefits. Everybody likes the shiny boats and the drug interdiction, and there's plenty of great things about the Coast Guard, but it's allowed them those kind of positives tend to help kind of bury the negatives, and every report that's come out in the last 3 or 4 years has showed they have terrible retention rates for women. They've got a huge, you know, big numbers of reported harassment at the Academy, which is the prestigious, you know, top of the line institution for the officer corps down the road. So it just seemed like this was in the era of Me Too, this was a story that needed to be told.
We did a show last week about Vanessa Guillen, the 20-year-old soldier who was murdered in Texas. And we've been doing shows about sexual harassment and rape in the military for, gosh, over 10 years now. Our guests say one of the main problems is that in the military, there's a huge bureaucracy, and basically the investigation is internal. And so the military commanders, you know, don't turn on each other. And that's what they're trying to really change here, is to bring in independent investigators and independent lawyers. Is that the situation in the Coast Guard?
That they bring independent lawyers?
No, that they don't. That's the problem.
Yeah. Well, they have, there are a couple of problems. One, they have, you know, they operate under a military justice system.
Right.
They have a process, a court-martial process, which allows them to have kind of the equivalent of traffic court. It's a summary court-martial where they can expel someone where it doesn't appear on their record. A future employer never knows that they were, you know, had five women harassing them. So it allows them to kind of sweep problems under the rug. So that's one issue, or the second issue. And then there's the good old boys network. I mean, there seems to be a real divide between younger Coast Guard folks who I think have come up with more of a culture of that this is inappropriate, and the older officers, you know, the people who are in their 40s and above, who you know, seem to operate under a different system, a different value system, kind of the good old boy club. But, you know, I can tell you that the response, we've had over, without giving exact numbers, let's say I've had over 65 people reach out with personal tales. Mm-hmm. Some of them go all the way back to the 70s. Some of them happened this year. And we'll be doing a lot more work on this story. But it, what is a common theme across the point, across these complaints where people come forward, and it's a theme that we tried to focus on, which was, you know, retaliation. Every single one of them who had come forward either had a career hiccup or in some cases were pushed out. One of the people who reached out that we haven't written about, I'll just talk in general, you know, said that when she reported a rape to her commander, she was punched in the chest and said, "Suck it up." Mm. So, you know, these are, you know, I think it goes to a question of culture and the fact that the commandant refuses to testify on the Hill and keeps sending his HR director, who famously ended last December's hearing by saying, "Well, you know, I don't think it's a problem, but if it is, we'd like to hear from them." The problem is when they hear from people, their careers hit a roadblock. Mm-hmm. And that's the issue at heart.
Can you tell us a little bit about Sarah Faulkner, the first woman to graduate from the Coast Guard's Helicopter Rescue Swimmer School in North Carolina? She joined their elite group of swimmers. She painfully describes how she was harassed for many, many years and how that experience just devastated her.
Yeah, I mean, our series, I should note with a caveat, that we were focused on the rescue swimmer world, which is about 3% of the total Coast Guard. So it's the swimmers and then their support teams with the rescue helicopters. So this is kind of the elite core of the Coast Guard in a way, that these are the heroic folks who jump from helicopters into the high seas to rescue people and things of the sort. She was the first woman to pass the swim rescue program that was offered by the Coast Guard. There were two women who came before her who had trained in the Navy's program. The Navy had a similar program, and that used to be the basis for passage. But she was the first to get through this Coast Guard's new ATTC school in Elizabeth City, North Carolina, in the year 2000. And within 6 months of passing that, when she in her first job, and she had been in the Coast Guard already before she did that. She had been up in Oregon and had worked 4 or 5 years, I believe, before she ever tried out for the rescue program, made it, and then was subjected to kind of, you know, pats, little things that would be on the smaller end of the scale, like, you know, pats on the butt and stuff like that, and then on the upper end of the scale, you know, downright crude sexual remarks in front of the, you know, her coworkers. That's where it started. They tried to push her out. When she complained about it, she refused to let that push her out. She stayed. She fought it for 16 years. And twice had fought what they were going to do, a voluntary discharge on medical grounds, on psychological grounds. And she never had a problem anywhere she was where she wasn't with the small world of rescue swimmers, and she never had a problem in rescue. She was constantly touted by the Coast Guard for all her rescues. But in the day-to-day dynamic of those units, her complaint from 2001 followed her whole career. And that was most apparent on the Veterans Affairs website, had a named her Veteran of the Day back when she retired. And most of the comments were these wonderful congratulations for your service, we're so proud of you, yada, yada. And then one of her coworkers said, "You're nothing but no different than anyone else. You're just a rescuer with a vagina." Mm. You know, and that kind of speaks to the mentality of what she was up against every single day. And I think her story, all three stories resonated, but hers resonated because I think the video was very powerful, and you could see how raw it is with her, you know, all these years later. It right. took a real toll on her, and I think a lot of women identified with that because it certainly is not limited to the Coast Guard. We've seen it in every walk of life, whether it's ours in the media, whether it's Hollywood, whether it's other branches of the military, you know. And it was interesting in the Guillen case that you mentioned, Wisconsin, one of the former leaders of the National Guard, a woman, got into all kinds of trouble because she said it's the price of admission. And that's the whole point. It shouldn't be the price of admission. It shouldn't be accepted as the price of admission for a woman in the armed forces to have to suffer that. You know, it shouldn't be on the women to just tolerate it.
Well, let's hear a clip from that video. This is Sarah Faulkner talking about what she experienced in the U.S. Coast Guard.
I joined the Coast Guard for the sole purpose to be a rescue swimmer. And I knew at the time that there hadn't been any females that had made it through the Coast Guard rescue swimmer school. I knew that I needed to be better than what was expected of me. So my harassment and technically assault started right away with my direct supervisor, with him slapping my rear. And this is in front of the entire shop. I can't even count how many times he did it, very hard. He would say, "Sarah, go in the chief's office, and you better be flat on your back when you get there." He'd say stuff about my nipples being hard, so I'm like aroused by him. Just endless. And whenever I tried to confront him about it, it was like, all of a sudden I was Cinderella, doing all the, you know, crap work and stuff. So my choices were let him harass me, or I had to choose being treated like absolute crap and ostracized by everybody. So I always had to pick what was the lesser of two evils, and they were both horrible. It was 16 years of sustained and compounded abuse, but I don't know if it was ego or what, but I was not going to let them take that away from me. But this is what it did to me. So it's like just talking about it, it's the hurt and the betrayal and the deviousness that I underwent. And I mean, the hurt that they caused me was so bad. I wished for death. I would wish a semi-truck would come and just run me off the road. That's how bad I hurt. So that's all still here, and I'm working on it, you know?
That is Sarah Faulkner talking about the harassment she faced in the U.S. Coast Guard. Kevin, she said that the Coast Guard's response to the harassment, the rape, the abuse, and the bullying is basically, who cares about the survivor? We're going to look out for number one, and that's the Coast Guard. She said that now that she's retired, she doesn't have to watch what she says.
Right. Right. And one of the challenges in reporting that story is some of the people, we had to be careful that we weren't quoting people who were active duty, because they don't have First Amendment rights like the rest of us. You know, they're basically owned by the service. So, we focused the other two stories on the wives, which, rightly, the story was about them, because they were the ones who were groped and harassed by superiors of their husbands, and then their husbands suffered if someone else or they reported the incident. Again, that theme throughout was the retaliation. But I think, just looking at the response of how many people have reached out with similar stories, which is what we had hoped for. We thought that if we got this out there, others would come forward with very similar tales, and in fact, that has happened. One of the little ironies on the story is the person who is quoted from the Coast Guard, their spokesman, Captain Anthony Russell. We didn't put this in the story, but in the middle, right towards the end of the story, he was suddenly gone. We couldn't figure out, well, gosh, he was engaged with us. He never really talked to us any further, and it turns out he went to work one day to the next, kind of went to work for the Connecticut Department of Energy and Environmental Safety, or I think that's the name, and the Coast Guard headquarters, of course, is in Connecticut as well, in New London, Connecticut. And it turns out he had been accused of bullying whistleblowers. So it wasn't a sexual context, but it had a context, so again, of trying to silence people who spoke out. So that we didn't want to go there, because it kind of distracted from the story we were trying to tell, but just the irony of it. So I think, I think there's going to be pressure on Congress. I think Congresswoman Speer, who heads the subcommittee on military personnel, although that's not really the committee's jurisdiction. I think she's going to be pushing this. I think Benny Thompson, I think, is the person with the committee of jurisdiction. I think I'm hoping the challenge, of course, is that this happens in a pandemic with the 10,000 other things that people are distracted by. But we hope that this will lead to some scrutiny and that they'll be held to the same kind of standard that the rest of the armed forces are. They're the smallest branch. They actually correspond to DHS, the Homeland Security, not Pentagon, even though they're considered part of the armed forces. So it's a little bit different dynamic.
And we're almost out of time, Kevin, but you report that the Coast Guard declined to comment on Sarah Faulkner's allegations.
Yeah, they wanted, on multiple stories, they wanted a privacy waiver. In the case of her, we had the documents, the public documents. There was no reason they couldn't comment on public documents. They could. They issued kind of a blanket comment, we wish her well. They claim it was investigated and they kind of hid behind the privacy waiver issue, and there is a privacy waiver, but when the people are talking to you and you've presented them the FOIAs and you've presented them the documents that these people are acknowledging, it's kind of an empty move to say, privacy concerns, prevent us from talking. So I think they just hope this will quietly go away. We also have been shared an internal communication where they pretty much put a gag order on everybody in North Carolina, telling them don't comment on Facebook, don't comment anywhere on this.
Wow. Well, Kevin, we're going to keep following this because a law by the name of I Am Vanessa Guillen is expected to be introduced on August 1st. According to her lawyer, it is going to have some teeth in it. So we'll find out next week.
Yeah,
find out what's in this.
We thought about linking to her story, but we were afraid that it might confuse two different issues. They are the same issue in some senses, but hers is much more than that.
Right. Well, Kevin, thank you so much for your work on this, and thanks for joining us.
Great. Thanks for having and giving attention to it.
Thank you. Kevin Hall is Chief Economics Correspondent and Senior Investigator at McClatchy Newspapers. And you can find the three-part series about allegations of sexual harassment in the U.S. Coast Guard at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.